Welcome to the last thing I saw, the Alfresco edition. There's just been a press screening of White Noise. To talk about the movie, which comes out later this fall on Netflix, I reached out. We probably both encountered it at the same time, so I think that was part of the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Lorenzen. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Nick.
It's your first time on the podcast, although yeah. I was just saying we did a talk once.
We did do a talk right here about 1984. The director, I can't remember who directed it. The Richard Burton, the adaptation starring Richard Burton done in the year 1984.
Yeah. It was a standalone talk because it was some sort of anti-censorship thing.
Something like that, yeah.
I forget what particular occasion it was, but yeah, White Noise, I saw it. It was opening night for the Venice Film Festival. And also for the New York Film Festival. Let's just go into it. Like, do you want to start with when you first encountered the book?
I first encountered the book when I was living in Greece in 1997.
Okay.
And I had, I believe I read a lot of it the day after I turned 21 years old on a bus with my school semester abroad group going to Delphi,
the Oracle.
yeah it wasn't exactly the right Delillo novel to read in Greece. That would be The Names, which is set there. But it was the first one I had encountered. Then I moved back home, I came back to Massachusetts and found that my father actually had first editions of his first two novels, Americana and End Zone, and that has translated into a lifelong habit of reading and rereading his books and writing about them now and then, which I'm doing again for N+1, which has brought me here.
Yes. It's been described as a novel that's hard to adapt or unadaptable.
For years... That's been, well, so much of the novel is kind of comic cultural commentary done at a slant to the actual action of the scenario in the narrative. Mm. And DeLillo himself has sometimes described the plot of the book as a trite adultery plot that he was using for the sake of getting the characters from here to there and pushing the narrative's confrontation with death, all plots moving deathward,
right,
to where it needed to go.
Yeah.
I think he says that in Paris Review interview he did with Adam Begley sometime in the early 90s.
Okay. I was thinking about the book and how it differs from other books where he is also doing the kind of theorizing the world kind of thing, culture comedy. And here... there's a bit of an extra move because it's in the format of like a campus novel in a way. So I wonder if there's a certain self-awareness on his part that I'm in the terrain where people theorize like this and I'm doing it too.
Well, there's an earlier book where he does that a lot, which would be End Zone, which is about a football team at a college called Logos College. I think it's in Texas, which has the first black running back in its league. And you get a lot of similarly self-conscious commentary in that book about analogizing football and nuclear war.
Okay. Right. Appropriately enough because of the nuclear football, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and I guess that might be one of the things that people are thinking of when talking about adapting it for the screen. So, you know, when you're watching it, a lot of it depends on, well, who's the director who's picking this up and who are the actors that he's going to put this, voice this stuff. For a director, I thought it's a pretty good match in the sense that Noah Baumbach often writes in this kind of, you know, at a slant, you were saying, remove where his characters are summing up the world around them.
They're highly self-conscious people,
yeah,
I suppose. And he himself is the son of a fiction writer and a film critic.
Do you like his books, his father's books? Have you read them?
I read a kind of Jonathan Baumbach omnibus when I was writing years and years ago, also for N+1, about the squid and the whale.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
It seems that if I were to ask a question at that press conference, which I decided not to do, it seems to me his vision of marriage has become a lot more hopeful since the squid and the whale and perhaps Marriage Story.
Yeah.
Babette and Jack, the married couple, come out of this Well, I don't. No spoilers, but I mean,
go ahead.
The novel has been out there for a while.
Yeah.
There is some just voiceover talk about hope at the very end of the film, which leads to a highly comic musical number.
Yes.
That's set to a great new LCD sound system song.
Tailor made for the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, and I wonder what you thought about that in terms of, in relation to the novel, because I guess I'm sort of assuming that everyone knows what the book is about.
The book is about a couple who've both been divorced 3 times previously, so they're both on their 4th marriage. Much like the Brady Bunch, they have a household full of children who are from the previous marriages. I think one difference between the novel and the adaptation is that the youngest child, Wilder, is said to be the son of Jack and Babette, whereas in the novel, she is Babette's younger son from a previous marriage, the other son of which is living in the outback in Australia, where he'll have no exposure to television and thus will grow up
pure,
without access to the codes
unique
to his species, I think the line is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good catch. I did not keep track of the family tree.
Yeah. So enough. I was wondering, given that the power of the narration in the novel, I was wondering whether voiceover would be a factor in this adaptation. And as far as I can remember, there was no voiceover really until the very end.
Yeah, I don't remember much anything either.
You do get right in the first barrage, because I read these chapters just a few hours ago because I was rereading again. You get a lot of exposition that comes out of Adam Driver's mouth as Jack Gladney, a mouth that is clean shaven, unlike the Gladney of the novel, who's bearded.
Yeah, which is significant. And I was kind of thinking about, not that we have to only compare it.
There's a lot of different hair differences. There's a lot of hair differences between the novel and the film. The novel has a teenage boy who has a prematurely receding hairline, whereas the actor who plays him, he's got a great head of hair.
He does. Not a factor.
Not a factor.
In the character.
And I hadn't thought of the important hair on Babette, as played by Greta Gerwig, said to be a mop in the novel, which makes one think of the Beatles. But I suppose if you have a stringy mop that you would use to clean floors, Greta Gerwig's perm, kind of micro perm in this, which looks very 80s,
it
could be said to be moppish in a different way.
It's true, yeah. But in a sense, it is a little strange, because in the 80s, I'm not sure her hair would have seemed that important, because it seems a little conventional in a way. When they say important hair, it was something I can't even conceive of what this
was. Yeah. Or just important in the eyes of her beloved. Yes. I mean, conventional in the way that you might mean trendy and of the moment, and as seen on television. Well, that's another one of the challenges that I thought was handled pretty well, is how much commentary there is about television in the novel, which was done sort of. There's a scene where one of the kids comes and says, plane crash footage on TV, let's go watch it, and that's handled rather economically.
Yeah.
But well done, too.
Yeah. He did seem to resist just having, too many chunks of the novel.
Yeah.
And we were just at the press conference where he's talking about, he said something like, I went back to the book afterwards, and it's like, oh, I guess I could have put that in. Yeah, that was pretty good. But just held back, which is pretty admirable. I mean, one example of where I think he goes kind of all out is like a big scene in the novel, kind of a set piece. The joining of the professors.
Oh yeah, the thing that surprised me about that, there's a counterpoint between the professor of Hitler studies, Jack, and Murray Susskind, played by Don Cheadle, who's a professor who's trying to be as Jack is to Hitler, he's trying to be to Elvis. Yeah. And in the novel, the lines that they deliver are given in counterpoint, which it's a mixture of counterpoint and crosstalk.
Right.
In the adaptation, with a lot of kind of visual spinning around a sort of circular classroom.
Yeah, it looks like samurai circling. Yeah. Ritual circling.
Jarring to me at first, but I guess crosstalk becomes another question besides the narration and how you incorporate the information and the kind of rich thought that is only found in the narration in the novel is how do you incorporate the famously gnomic DeLillo dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And here the technique seemed to be a lot of crosstalk and a lot of kind of like almost like an aria of just a barrage of lines that might be disconnected but are all on a theme and often sound the way they're written, but also much more so the way they're delivered, like poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so you get to the question of kind of like, I felt in the first 10 or 15 minutes or so that it was more theatrical, almost more like the experience of seeing a Shakespeare adaptation than a naturalistic Noah Baumbach movie.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Especially in the way, less so with the kids, but more so especially with Driver and Gerwig, and especially Driver, who seemed to be kind of like stretching his range.
Yeah, I remember when I saw it, I thought, I think maybe the kids were my favorite part in terms of performances. And yeah, Adam Driver, it's strange. In a way, I would have thought he would be well suited to it just because if he can sometimes find this kind of idiosyncratic tension that he brings to his delivery. And I thought he could find that here. But yeah, in this case, he doesn't bring the personality I would expect, especially given how it dominates the book, that narrating voice.
I haven't seen everything he's done with Baumbach. I've definitely seen While We're Young. I haven't seen Marriage Story, actually.
Yeah, I like Marriage Story, yeah.
It struck me, one of my first thoughts watching him play Gladney was of Woody Allen's surrogate. Sort of like John Cusack in Bullets Over Broadway or Kenneth Branagh in Celebrity.
Yeah.
As the film went on, I felt more at ease with him in his kind of the way his voice breaks sometimes when he's kind of can't believe this you know, that what is Babette? Why, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's almost hard to separate the actor from the character as the movie evolves, just in the sense that I think he begins with a lot of bombast and that's his authority and he's very comfortable in that. And the whole movie is, you know, part of the threat is him, that the authority not serving him anymore because he doesn't know what to do when the civilization collapses. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's part of why he tones it down.
Well, he's also a professor who's a phony.
Yeah, he's a phony.
So he's a figure of authority, but he doesn't know how to speak German, which is his fraudulent element.
Yeah.
I thought the film was very good at bringing out the sort of like flim-flam, con man aspects of, for lack of a better term, American adulthood. Because the kids are at least, in addition to being like super knowing, are also kind of super innocent in their way too. Yeah. And they're not necessarily bound to these, all of the distractions that the adults are constantly seeking out, whether it be chewing gum and smoking in Babette's case or becoming a bullshit guru of Hitler in the case of Jack Gladney.
Yeah.
One of the strong themes of the novel is that you have these adults kind of like one generation separated from the Second World War and the Holocaust, living in the safety of this affluent college town where everybody shows up with station wagons full of loot. And it's kind of the height of American materialism.
Yeah, comfort.
Yeah. The film seemed much more interested in Elvis than in Hitler.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's something that made me think about the book in a new way, actually, that the way the movie was doing that differently. Because the book, I when I read it, which I guess was the late 90s as well, didn't feel as much of its time as it does now. And I'm not saying it's dated. I think that's kind of a meaningless word. I just mean that it it's, as you say, it's written in a cultural moment.
There are a lot of Hitler jokes in the book, but this novel was published probably 13 years after The Producers, at least.
Okay.
But yeah. In terms of its, like, in terms of where it's situated in a literary tradition, mm-hmm. in a larger literary critical moment, it's kind of coming after the big moment for postmodern fiction and metafiction that you get with William Gaddis, Thomas Pynchon, John Barth in the, let's say, in the 60s and early 70s, and embedding that sort of self-consciousness within a conventional narrative framework of mm-hmm. the campus novel, the disaster
yeah.
event, and the trite adultery plot, right? Right? So you have the famous scene, which is left out of the film adaptation, of the of when Murray Susskind and mm-hmm. Jack Gladney go to the next town over. It has a funny name. The town where College on the Hill is called Blacksmith. The big city nearby is called Iron City. Oh. I forget the name of the town with the most photographed barn in right. America.
Yeah.
Right.
What so happened to the barn?
There's this. Yeah. There's a sense. Well. Did it need to be photographed again by Noah Baumbach? Maybe not.
That's true.
Yeah. So the ideas, I always thought that that connected right to Walter Benjamin's like Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, or many Baudrillard essays about simulation, or his big book about Las Vegas, for yeah. example, or just his book called America, which is largely about Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that... It didn't seem to me that Baumbach played those aspects of the novel up as much as he could have.
No, no.
And maybe that is a kind of shrewd notion on his part, in that by now those ideas are actually very old.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about DeLillo is the question of whether he's seeing things as they are at present, or whether he is prescient. This is a
right.
constant trope of any literary writing about DeLillo. And certainly my recent like tour through White Noise, there's a passage not in the adaptation where Murray J. Susskind says, "Oh, you're going to have a handyman come over and fix this for you? Don't you know that anybody who fixes things for you is a bigot?" And it was like, coastal elites and Trumpists right there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, another thing from the book that I didn't really know is this whole idea of like a New York, like...
Yeah, the New York mob. Exiles. They're like, at one point in the novel, Babette says to Murray, "How do you know so much?" He says, "I'm from New York."
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's played down. And it even... One thing that the film adaptation gave away is that the Gladney station wagon has Ohio plates.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It's always unclear to me where... But it also seemed as if they were in New... At the very end, they were in New Jersey and possibly approaching Manhattan. It looked like the Chrysler building there.
That's true, yeah. It did look like that approach.
That maybe that's either not meaningful or some kind of sleight of hand.
Right, accident or just location.
When they meet the Greek or the German nuns.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
There's another interesting aspect of DeLillo, which is not a part of Baumbach's work, I've always had a theory that there's a lot of either right there on the surface or crypto-Catholicism.
In Baumbach's work?
No, in DeLillo's work. And it really comes out with the German nuns at the end mm-hmm. who deliver the importance is the appearance that someone believes that there's a heaven. The
right.
speech that the nun gives in German to Babette. Yeah. Although, why would she even now that I think about right. it, why would she understand it?
Yeah.
Maybe Jack translates it for her.
Yeah. No, that's it. That's a kind of thorny aspect of the novel that I noticed when I reread it for the film. Just because there is something a little, maybe just a little weird about Hitler studies.
Yeah.
It's the focus on it. I mean, like.
But it's also, let's take it on its face, it's a direct parody of the directions in which academia was running at the at the time.
But of all things, it chooses one thing, which, you know.
Well, Murray's other thing, he's like, the professors are starting to not read literature, not study film, not even study comic books, but study the sides of cereal boxes, right?
Yes.
Which is...
Well, that's definitely the cultural studies direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but actually... Just thinking about the visuals, the specific visuals of some
Listen
of the
to
film.
Us classicists over here. we're
huddled. You should see us. We're huddled in the shade of a, well, I don't know. This isn't exactly a Doric column, but...
a brutalist.
brutalist columns. No, I mean, I was thinking about how it particularly visualized some things and how that affects its adaptation of the novel.
What did you think of this film's vision of the 1980s?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that filmmakers have developed a kind of neurosis about representing the 80s, basically, where they don't want to do it too exactly because they're afraid it'll seem like they're doing a caricature or that it'll just scream 80s and no one wants to do that.
Yeah.
And then they've also all internalized this idea, which I think is right, that any given decade doesn't just have all the signifiers of that decade.
It has everything that's come before,
exactly.
too. Yeah. My little note that I wrote down here somewhere was... effective recreation of the 2000s idea of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the brightness of the colors. It, on the one hand, you know, so that was the hipster trucker hat decade, you know, when we arrived here in New York. But I realized then that my favorite T-shirt that I wore during the aughts or during the, you know, second Bush administration was a bright green T-shirt, which was very much of the color palette of this film. And that T-shirt I had saved from childhood, and it was put out to commemorate the opening of the first ATM in my hometown of Hopkinton, Massachusetts in 1983. And it was just a wonderful bright green T-shirt,
awesome.
And eventually it disintegrated.
From
so there was some, there's both like the American Apparel aesthetic that was trying to do that 80s thing was too much, but it was also true. And this movie struck me as being similar. And I was thinking about it in my head. The default, it seemed to me for a while, on period pieces about the 70s, particularly I'm thinking of the adaptation of Dennis Johnson's Jesus Son.
Oh, yeah.
And the Gary Oldman starring adaptation of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is to pastelify the 1970s.
Yeah.
And at least we've gotten away from that into more bright primary colors here.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Of all things, this is reminding me of I finally watched Speed Racer on a plane recently. And I felt like Speed Racer. Okay, stay with me.
Yeah.
Speed Racer is the Wachowski team doing the 70s in colors with the brightness that they felt they deserved because they went through the 90s doing their own movies, which were these neo-noir things.
Yeah, yeah.
But around them were these terrible, like, adaptations of 70s TV shows
right,
that were going
yeah.
on. So I felt like Speed Racer, they're like, finally, okay, let's do it how it actually is. Anyway, yeah, I agree that about the colors. But something about the movie, like, it very much is like an 80s in retrospect. And I feel like at one point they have some reference to that famous photo of a supermarket, you know, the one where it's just these layered... You're looking into a supermarket.
Is it Andreas Gursky?
I think
Yeah.
Which
I think actually comes from either the late 90s or the early 2000s.
Yeah, yeah. So that
I think that supermarket that Gursky photographs might be in Europe.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I'm gonna look this all up because it's relevant. But I feel like the Gursky photograph provided kind of almost more of like a framework for the.
Yeah.
Grocery store, the supermarket scenes. The other thing about the supermarket scenes is that I wonder, like, did Cheerios pay for product placement? Because on the one hand, Cheerios has to be in there. But on the other hand, why not? Why wouldn't Netflix go to them and say, like, you're going to get a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
And then there seemed to be the Brillo, lots of shots of, it would be like, it was like, Cheerios, Doritos, Brillo. And it was like, is Brillo just a Warhol reference or what?
Yeah. The things that were the cliches for generic, which for brands then aren't necessarily carried through. And also...
And there's a generic aisle.
Yeah.
Which in the novel, Murray's favorite aisle to shop from because the food is all mushy, and he doesn't feel like he has to affiliate with any brands, and obviously it's cheaper too.
Yeah.
And he's an adjunct bachelor. But they, I was impressed that they did not deal with that at all in the film until the musical number at the end.
Right. Yeah. The Brand X.
Yeah.
I don't even know if people know what Brand X is anymore.
Well,
than
I
don't know.
I certainly default to them when I'm at Rite Aid getting like, I don't know, whatever ointment I need.
Yeah, what is the brand? The Brand X brand is like Nice or something. It's like Nice to the next place you put it. Like
it depends
on the place.
an old friend of ours, when I was roommates with him at the beginning of our time in New York, used to buy D'Agostino's light beer.
Oh,
which is essentially a brand. The house brand is the same as Brand X.
Right, brewed in the butchery aisle or something.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to float just for to see what you think of is, speaking again of like the visuals of the movie.
Mm.
One thing that I noticed about the novel is that the touchstones in terms of movies are classic Hollywood. And this actually came up in the press conference. They're not, for a novel that's about like the contemporary landscape, there's amazingly little of the actual contemporary pop culture landscape in the DeLillo.
In the book.
In the movie, I think they find a way to do that.
I think with DeLillo, you have to realize he's kind of filtering in the pop culture of his own childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the stuff about contemporary pop culture in the novel is a parody of it.
Yeah.
For instance, I think there's a throwaway line about a group of multiracial children repairing a sitcom about a group of multiracial children repairing a satellite.
Yeah.
Right. Which is not, you know, it's probably a joke about Different Strokes in a way,
right.
But there was never an episode of Different Strokes where that happened.
I mean, what I had in mind specifically was what he's doing is Baumbach uses the styles of 80s movies or has 80s movies.
Oh, well, I mean, the Spielberg middle section of this movie is, feels so Spielberg.
And that's how he gets that in there somehow.
Yeah.
So in a way, I thought he almost added to the novel in that way.
I mean, I wasn't quite sure if the madcapness of that section was faithful to the spirit of the novel.
Yeah.
And also having seen Nope recently with all of its kind of like finger in the eye of Spielberg use of his tropes from had me kind of craving more of less of a tribute and more of a twist.
Skepticism, yeah. About it. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in terms of filmic references,
yeah.
I had always thought that the confrontation between Jack and the Doctor had a lot in common with the confrontation between Humbert and Quilty in Lolita.
Oh, uh-huh.
And in this confrontation between Jack and the Doctor in the Baumbach movie read to me like as having a lot in common with Kubrick's adaptation where James Mason and Peter Sellers confront each other in a madcap way at the end at the end of Kubrick's adaptation of Lolita.
That's interesting. I almost wonder if that's a function of people adapting novels for the screen. Yeah. In a great, it's like, here's a part of the novel that we can, is a drama. It's two people in a room. It's strange. I mean, with the ending here of the movie White Noise, I thought of the ending of the movie Cosmopolis, I think. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, he changes the novel in the sense that Babette is with him in the going to the motel, because I don't remember that being the way it is in the novel.
There's also the big scene that's missing is the Wilder on the highway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Think of that as Toddler on the highway.
Well, and then in terms of 80s movie references, they definitely have a Julie Haggerty person in the when they're in that like camp where they're the way.
Oh yeah,
remember
yeah,
she's
yeah.
talking
she's,
like Julie Haggerty.
It's
totally Julie Haggerty.
Yeah,
and it's
I hadn't thought of that.
I was like, what is he doing here exactly? And I thought it just had to be a way of somehow like that more than anything makes it feel like the 80s. Mm. You know, so that was kind of interesting to me of kind of putting that in. And also the whole station wagon here when it's a station wagon is on screen with this kind of madcap, not very DeLillo and Chase or whatever it is.
It feels like the Goonies or like
National Lampoon's
Vacation. Yeah, National Lampoon's Vacation also. Yeah, indeed.
Maybe Adam Driver thought he was more in that movie at that point. But I don't know. Those seem so intentional that I felt that was somehow a visual strategy. If I ever get to talk to him, I will ask him. Well, what else? We covered everything. I don't know. Oh, I mean, the only other thing is, I mean, the parental concealment thing is definitely like a Baumbach theme already. So that's another way.
Well, know. Yeah. I mean, he's, like I said, I thought this was his most hopeful vision of marriage.
Yeah, it's, yeah. But he, partly by acknowledging the male oblivion aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, he really steers into that more than almost the novel, which gets so caught up in his head that I don't think we get that perspective that you have it on the screen.
Mm. I mean, it's a big production for Baumbach, like much bigger than anything I'm aware of. Well, he said it during the press conference that there were more people in any given scene than in any of all of his other movies combined.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody else about just the, oh, after reading Nick Pinkerton's piece about Kevin Smith this week, did you read that?
I did as well, yeah.
Fantastic piece.
Compulsively read it.
One of the pieces of the year. But particularly with its comparison of Clerks 3 and Rifkin's Festival and the different possibilities for a director of such and such generation.
Right.
And it does feel like with his Netflix, whatever he's worked out, he is, I there were stories about people dying and this movie going way over budget,
yeah.
But I hope they just keep giving him all that money.
Bucket loads of money, yeah.
And also to his peers.
And to his peers, yeah. It is, it's great because you have a filmmaker who kind of does, I mean, movies that are partly about ideas and not calling them like comedies of manners doesn't really cover it, I think. So it's interesting to see him get this canvas, but that made me think of one other thing that maybe we can sort of wrap things together, which is what is the movie equivalent of like a book of ideas in a way, and who are the filmmakers to do that, and then of course Godard has to go and
Sure.
That's what sort of came to mind.
Well, I mean, I watched Contempt last week when I'd been asked to write about the death of Queen Elizabeth. And I got very bored by it and turned down the assignment.
Okay.
And then just watched Contempt. And it's a self-conscious literary adaptation of Alberto Moravia's wonderful novel. And it is constantly commenting on the literary tradition, but also at the same time, the nature of marriage and adultery itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean... Is there anybody still out there doing this? I mean, we've got to encourage anybody who's coming close to it, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to end on. It was just somehow, Godard just dropping dead made me think of that. I mean,
White Noise. It's Contempt with a different tone and a big musical number.
That's our pull quote.
And a happy ending. Contempt with a happy ending.
Contempt with a happy ending. All right, well, we'll wrap up there, but thank you for taking time.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It's great to see you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.